Okay.
That's a great
friend. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law.
Love is the law. Love your will.
Good evening. Welcome to Arise and Lodge's fourth Wednesday class. Tonight's we're going to talk about insight meditation. Since it's a class on meditation, I thought, what better way than to just begin with some meditation? So get yourselves comfortable. Whatever's comfortable for you. And close your eyes and settle in as we meditate a little bit. Just begin by focusing your attention on the breath. Either focus at the abdomen. Just start to experience the sensations of the breath at the abdomen. Experience the rise and fall of the abdomen. Try to notice if the breath is coming in long or if it's coming in short. If you notice any tension at the abdomen, just try to adjust the breath so that the breath is easier. You notice any sense of pushing or pulling the breath? Just try to let go of that pushing and pulling. Just try to get the breath to be as comfortable as possible. If you'd like, you can try to visualize the breath energy coming in directly at the abdomen, right through the pores of the skin. Let the attention move up to the chest area. Experience the breath coming in at the chest with the inhalation and leaving through the exhalation. Again, if you notice any pushing or pulling of the breath here, just try to make that more relaxed. So that the breath is just coming in at the chest naturally and going out just as easily. Do the same thing now with the shoulders. Visualize the breath energy coming in straight into the shoulders. Relax any tension at the shoulders. Let the attention move down into the arms. Down past the elbows. The muscles in the forearms. all the way down into the tips of the fingers. Visualize the breath energy moving easily in and out through the arms and the hands. Now feel the breath energy moving in and out of the whole head. Not just through your nose and mouth, but throughout the entire head. Now let the attention move down the neck and back. And do the same thing there. Now feel the breath energy in the left leg. Relinquish any sense of pushing or pulling or tension in the left leg. All the way down to your foot. Do the same thing for the other leg. Bring your attention back to the breath at the abdomen. Notice the sensations of inhalation and exhalation. Feel what the inhalation is like. Feel how it differs from the exhalation. mind moves off of the breath, just notice that and bring it back to the breath. Notice the pause at the bottom of the exhalation. Notice the pause at the top of the inhalation. Notice those four parts of the breath. Inhalation as it's happening. The pause. The exhalation as it's happening. And the pause. Try to notice each part as it's happening. Feel the inhalation as it's happening. Feel what it's like at the beginning of the inhalation. Feel what it's like at the end of the inhalation. Mind loses interest in the breath, it's okay, just bring it back. Take a look at the exhalation. What's the beginning of the exhalation like? How does that feel? How does the exhalation feel as it ends? Descends into the pause. tension move out into your body, into your hands and into your feet. Move your toes and your fingers around a little bit. Feel your awareness coming back into the room. And when you're ready, open up your eyes. Good evening again. Tonight's class is on the subject of insight meditation, which you guys just got to sample a little bit of. Insight meditation, or Vipassana, is a form of meditation that has its roots in Theravada Buddhist tradition, which is the type of Buddhism practiced in Southeast Asia. It is distinct from other forms of meditation in that its purpose is to grant the practitioner firsthand insight into what are called the three characteristics of conditioned phenomena. By the end of this class, you should have a pretty good idea of what that means, how to actually practice insight meditation, and how to avoid the most common pitfalls people encounter when they attempt insight meditation or really meditation of any kind. But I want to do more today than simply show you how to do insight meditation. I also want to make insight meditation intelligible as a human activity. In other words, I also want you to leave today understanding why someone would want to meditate. To this end, my talk will consist in three parts. First, I will cover fundamentals of meditating. Good meditation does not occur in a vacuum. It has discernible causes. Then we will look in detail at insight meditation in particular, seeing how it is done and how to avoid common pitfalls while doing it. Finally, we will look at the effects typically produced by insight meditation. By examining these downstream effects, we will be in a position to critically examine the practice of insight meditation and also, to some degree, mystical attainment in general. Before I begin, though, I would like to lay out the assumptions underlying what I'm about to tell you, as they probably differ from those held by other meditation teachers. This is not a Dharma talk. None of what I'm about to tell you is a spiritual teaching in the sense of being unconditioned knowledge possessed by the wise. What I'm about to say comes from my own experience and experiences shared with others, so a bit of my personal history seems in order. For most of my adult life, I had very little interest in spirituality, mysticism, or even meditation. Like many people, I attempted meditation on and off throughout my adolescence and adulthood, but could never seem to get any traction with the practice. Perhaps one reason for this is that it never occurred to me exactly why someone should meditate. We're given signals in our culture that meditation is somehow inherently good. This is supported by the occasional scientific study, but mostly it seems to be because meditation comes from the East, along with all things that are supposedly good. I began meditating in earnest in 2011 when I signed up for a mindfulness-based stress reduction class. MBSR, or a mindfulness-based stress reduction, or MBSR, is a technique developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn at UMass. Initially a treatment for chronic pain, the technique was expanded to deal with stress in general. Nowadays, its application is sometimes so broad that it has assumed the status of a quasi-absolute life philosophy. But the essence of MBSR seems to be a combination of meditation and psychotherapeutic approaches to teach a person to better tolerate stress. The assumption of MBSR is that we are in a better position to enjoy our lives and weather uncomfortable or painful circumstances if our awareness is centered on the present moment. The idea is that by being more attentive to what is happening right here, right now, we're able to make a more meaningful impact on our lives than if we're constantly thinking about the past or the future. This message resonated with me, as it does with many people. I was also pretty sure my chances of establishing a regular meditation practice would increase if I paid someone $500 to teach me. As it turned out, I was correct. After the class, I continued meditating regularly. I also began reading just about anything I could get my hands on the subject of meditation, especially Vipassana. It was around this time that I came across a book called Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha by Daniel Ingram. The message of this book was relatively straightforward. Ingram argues persuasively that insight meditation is a powerful technique of liberation, but it has been rendered ineffective by confusing it with psychotherapy and self-analysis. If one follows simple instructions, Ingram claims, it is possible in a relatively short period of time to begin to experience what the Buddha himself experienced. I soon found out this book was merely one part of a growing counterculture within the American Buddhist subculture. It called itself Pragmatic Dharma, and I encountered many of its practitioners through the Dharma Overground and the Buddhist Geeks podcast, which now also hosts a yearly conference. Pragmatic Dharma's practitioners come from many backgrounds, including Mahayana and Vajrayana Buddhism, and even Western esotericism, though they are loosely connected by shared values. These values include an emphasis on practice rather than faith, an eclecticism that encourages mastery of techniques across traditions, a desire to experience mystical attainment for oneself rather than just read about it in books, the rejection of religious and cultural taboos, and often frank and open discussions surrounding attainments and the results of consistent practice. Over the years, I have had the chance to collaborate with and learn from many practitioners within this vital growing tradition. As a result, Pragmatic Dharma has had an enormous impact on the way I understand contemplative practice, and this impact is visible in the way I will treat the subject of insight meditation today. I will treat insight meditation as a human activity subject to normal laws of cause and effect. Rather than simply take for granted that one ought to meditate, let alone do Vipassana, I will show you what I know about the effects of intensive insight and let you decide for yourself whether it is something you wish to pursue. This will require us to examine the spiritual attainments that follow from intensive insight and to treat them as fundamentally no different in kind from normal attainments, such as becoming competent at French or learning to paint. Indeed, in keeping with my pragmatic background, I would like to convince you that spiritual development really is normal development, and that those who engage in spiritual development are not intrinsically better than people who do not. Those of us who have had religious or mystical experiences can easily fall prey to the illusion that such experiences are unique, deeply personal, or somehow make us special. And yet a Pew Forum poll a few years ago showed that 48% of Americans have reported having had mystical experiences, as compared with 22% mid-century. We're discovering these experiences are not as uncommon as we think, and that they have common traits and common causes which we can understand and learn from. We're also learning that these experiences do not necessarily make us special as individuals. Initially, this realization challenges our sense of self-importance. And yet by contextualizing such transcendent experiences, we're able to move beyond them. We find that it's possible to transcend transcendence itself. Or more accurately, we find we're able to exceed our own subjective, partial ideas of what counts as transcendence, as well as the partial sense of self we build around such experiences. In this way, we move toward a fuller, deeper, more complex, and more comprehensive understanding of ourselves and reality. Of course, some of you may have no real interest in or motivation to achieve transcendence, real or imaginary. Perhaps you're simply interested in using meditation to become more patient, more focused, or more effective. In my opinion, this is a perfectly legitimate use of meditation, and all of the foundational material I cover today will be of use to you in pursuing those goals. I would, however, offer one piece of advice at the outset. While some studies have suggested meditation can have positive effects on our mood, focus, and behavior, there is no reason I've seen that meditation is inherently better than other means, such as taking medication prescribed by a psychiatrist, distracting oneself with a good book or television program, talking it out with someone, or even moderate consumption of alcohol or cannabis. There is as yet no in principle reason to recommend meditation or mindfulness over these other means. This is both useful and kind to keep in mind. In short, I advocate passionate but critical pursuit of the spiritual path, whatever it is. But it is my opinion that the best way to achieve this is by the elimination of unnecessary taboos surrounding talking about practice. Whether one is interested in meditation in order to achieve lofty things or to learn more patience, it is necessary to first have a strong grasp of the fundamentals. Meditation is like erecting a building. If the foundation is weak, or if the soil you're trying to build in is not the right type, the building falls over. It won't matter how lofty or simple your aspirations are, because you won't even get past the point of your mind wandering all over the place. This leads to discouragement and finally abandoning the practice. So we need to really focus on the foundation first so that you stand the best chance of having a fruitful meditation. Before I get into the specifics, a few general remarks on practice may be useful to those who have had little experience with meditating. There are different kinds of meditation, and different kinds of meditation are practiced in different ways. The kind of meditation I'm going to teach you about today, Vipassana, or insight meditation, can be practiced sitting, standing, walking, or even lying down. Most of my instructions will be geared toward the meditator who is sitting with their eyes closed following the breath. The instructions only need to be modified slightly to take into account standing, walking, or lying down. However, I would encourage you to avoid lying down at the beginning, as you may find it too easy to nod off. Some people make an enormous deal out of how to sit, as though the only meditation will only work if you're stock still, if your back is perfectly straight, if you're sitting in a full lotus position on a special kind of zafu. It's really beside the point. You should experiment and just do with what works best for you. I recommend sitting as still and as straight as you can in a hard chair with your feet on the floor, like we did today, or if you prefer to sit cross-legged on a cushion, you can do that as well. If you have to move, just do so slowly and carefully, as though you were a bird watcher reading for their binoculars. I recommend setting a timer so you're doing your meditation for a fixed period of time. In order to do the kind of meditation I'm going to teach you today, you really ought to sit for no less than 40 minutes. The reason for this is that it usually takes 20 or 30 minutes just for the mind to calm down enough to get to work. This leaves you 10 to 20 minutes where you can really get the meditation going. Start with 10 or 20 minutes and increase it gradually so you don't freak out. I recommend meditating every day. Meditation is a skill that's acquired surprisingly quickly, but it's also lost quickly. Therefore, it's important to keep momentum, and that's best achieved by doing the practice every day. It doesn't really matter what time of day you decide to do the practice, except that you do it at a time that's best for you. I'll have more to say about that in a moment. A few times throughout the talk, I'm going to refer to meditation retreats. A meditation retreat is when you go off someplace quiet, usually for about a week or longer, to meditate in isolation or in a group. While meditation retreats are useful, and while I encourage anyone interested in intensive practice to try one, they are by no means necessary in order to do any of the things I'm talking about today. Probably the most important piece of advice, keep a diary. You want to record each of your meditation sessions in a journal. Record the date, time, your physical and mental conditions. Write down how long ago you ate, the last time you had caffeine or a nap, etc. You're going to see why in a moment. Also write down exactly what you were intending to do and what happened. I'll show you examples of good and bad reporting later, but in general, you want to remain as much as possible at a bare sensate first-person level. In other words, you want to describe as well as you can what happened without getting too much into theories about things. I'm going to show you in a moment what I mean by that. Okay, so we have basic setup. You set aside some time. You set the timer for 40 minutes, however long you're going to do it. You sit down. You close your eyes. You focus on the breath. And, of course, the attention stays right there, right? And you go directly into samadhi, achieve complete liberation pretty much a moment later, right? Really what happens is you immediately start thinking about a conversation with someone earlier in the day, or you fall asleep, or you probably do both if you're like me. Start having meditation dreams. The timer goes off, and if you haven't already gone off to make dinner or you're having a dream, you probably noticed maybe 3 or 4 inhalations, right? You encounter the problem meditators call monkey mind. Monkey mind is when the mind jumps around from thought to thought like a monkey swinging from the tree. Or maybe the mind starts to settle on the breath, but it almost seems to fall into or through the breath, and soon you find yourself nodding off. The two typical responses here are either to conclude that your concentration sucks or to bring acceptance to the mind. The second one is wrong, because our purpose is to actually develop some skill meditating, and that's never going to be accomplished if you just simply accept whatever the mind does. The first is technically correct. Your concentration really does suck. That is the problem. The problem, though, is that you're treating concentration as a single phenomenon, and you're treating it as a mere choice or like a lack of willpower. In fact, concentration is a complex phenomenon. It is composed of parts, and the parts rest on their own foundations. We do not have direct control over concentration itself, but we do have some control or some influence over the parts. Unfortunately, there's no way to guarantee the mind is going to do exactly what we want it to do. However, there are some things we can do to make it more likely that it's going to do what we want. This is why before we worry explicitly about the mind, we should worry about the body first. Generally, if the body is calm, the mind is going to follow suit. This is why it is helpful to begin your meditation session by doing some kind of a relaxation exercise, similar to what we did at the beginning of the class. You want to go through each part of the body, eliminating any tension or strain that you find. There are a few guided meditations like this online. I like the one that Tanisaro Bhikkhu has on Audio Dharma. If you go on there and search for him, you'll find one of his guided meditations. Or you can just do it yourself. I mean, as you saw, it was pretty simple. You just go through each part of the body and relax it. In any event, once the body is relaxed, you should try to remain still. It's not necessary to remain stock still in order to do this kind of meditation. But in general, the fewer interruptions coming from your body, the more likely you'll attain stillness of mind. And even if calming and stilling your body does not lead to a mind as calm as you would like, it's still a lot easier to meditate for 40 minutes if your body's relaxed. The inability of the mind to concentrate is going to bother you a lot less, which actually makes it more likely that concentration is going to occur either in that session or in a subsequent one. The teacher Ajahn Brahm somewhere says that achieving concentration in a meditation is like receiving a paycheck for working. We don't say the work we did Monday through Thursday was for naught just because we only get paid Friday. Or maybe you do, I don't know. I probably do. Likewise, those sessions where you are unable to achieve concentration are not worthless. They're building toward the later payoff. So long as you work regularly at building the foundation, as I'm describing, you're raising the likelihood of having a session where your concentration is stronger. So you want to keep that kind of medium-term view of things in mind as you're beginning. But sometimes we have the opposite problem. The mind is just too sleepy. The mind seems to land right on the breath, but it's almost like it's falling into the breath instead of observing it. And before you know it, you're that person in the retreat hall who's snoring loudly. If you're sleepy, the first thing you can do is open your eyes partially to let in a little bit of light. If that doesn't work, you can open your eyes fully. If that doesn't work, you can tug on your ears. This is when the Buddha actually suggests, just pull on your ears a few times. If that doesn't work, you can do the meditation while standing. And if that doesn't work, you can do the meditation while walking. I'm a big fan of walking meditation because I have real sleepiness issues sometimes. I've done tons and tons of walking meditation. If none of those work, take a nap, have a cup of coffee. It's not the end of the world, basically. Generally, meditation is most successful when we have the right amount of energy. We want enough that the mind can do the work of observing, but we don't want so much that it's too anxious to stay with the object. We want to be calm enough that the mind isn't racing every which way, but we don't want to be nodding off. Most people find certain circumstances are more conducive to getting the balance right than others. For some, it's first thing in the morning after a cup of coffee. That's me. That's when I like to meditate. Most don't do well at 2 in the afternoon after lunch. Some prefer late at night. I have a friend who only does it late at night after he puts his kids down for bed. There's nothing written in stone saying you have to be an effective meditator all the time under every single circumstance. I recommend trying a few different times a day in different circumstances. Be sure to record the results of each session in your journal or diary, and it'll make it easier to pick out the patterns. So we're not even talking about meditation at this point, but we are talking about the level of physical energy that makes for easy or difficult meditation. But already you're put in the position of having to learn about yourself. This is a common denominator in all of this kind of work. You have to learn how your own nervous system works and then figure out how you can intervene to optimize its performance. So the right amount of kind of energy, that's the soil of our practice, what I'm calling level one here, okay? Next, we have to build the foundation in the soil, and that's establishing mindfulness. Mindfulness, or sati, is the ability of the mind to stay with an object. That object can be the breath, the body, a mantra, a visualization, the auditory field, the entire field of experience, a quality of mind. We can be mindful of any object of experience. In this class, we're mostly going to be talking about the breath. And later on, we'll talk a little bit about mantra. But what I'm saying here about the establishment of mindfulness applies in any case where you're trying to build concentration. This can mean following the breath, it can mean reciting an invocation, it can mean visualizing a deity or a drawn pentagram. Whatever the task, mindfulness is the application of the mind to that task. So we have mindfulness, or sati, as the thing we want to establish, but mindfulness can't operate on its own. It needs help, and that comes in the form of two additional faculties of mind, alertness and ardency. Alertness is the ability of the mind to watch what it is doing. If the mind is being mindful of the object, alertness knows that. If the mind is not being mindful of the object, if it's off thinking about dinner instead, alertness knows that too, and it sends up the alarm. If we wanted to put things in technical language, we would say alertness is a second-order mental process, and mindfulness is a first-order mental process. Ardency is the mental quality of keeping at the task. So when the mind strays from the object, ardency brings it right back without delay. But it does it impartially. It doesn't scold the mind. It doesn't shove the mind into the object. It just brings it back. And it does this once, 10 times, 200 times in a session if necessary, right? Very neutral. So the first thing to notice is that the establishing of mindfulness, satipatthana, It's a complex process. It's not a simple process. Too often we hear that mindfulness is just bare awareness of the object, a kind of dumb, thoughtless staring at things. In fact, there's a lot that has to go into establishing mindfulness. There's the application of the mind to the object, the mindfulness itself, but there are the second-order processes, the alertness and ardency, too. What this means is that if something goes wrong and you can't seem to establish mindfulness, you don't have to just reach for the bottle right away. You can observe and try to figure out what's going on at what level with the mind. The problem may be occurring at the level of physical energy, in which case you can intervene at that level using the methods that I just gave you. Or maybe your mind is thinking about one particular thing. It just has a thought that's going and it won't let go of. You can intervene and attempt to see the downside of thinking about that thing. You can try to think about the benefits of meditating instead. I'm going to show you a technique later on, one that mixes insight with mantra that will help circumvent these tendencies in the mind to overthink. So if you're the kind of person who has a problem with the monkey mind, this is a good way, this is a good hack into that. And once you get proficient at insight meditation, you can even turn the thoughts themselves into objects of meditation as they're occurring. The point is that between all these methods, you can often get the mind to relinquish its grasp on the intruding thoughts and get back to work. So again, this is going to require you to get to know your mind, get to know your nervous system, get to know your body, get to know what's going on, whatever it takes to get it to settle down and work. Another thing we have to think about is right effort in connection with ardency. If you're forceful with yourself, then meditation's not going to work. And you're going to just get discouraged and stop. You don't want to be too lenient with yourself either. You know, mindfulness doesn't mean radical acceptance. It requires you to say no to yourself when the mind is doing something it shouldn't be doing. But this self-disciplining has to be done in an almost mechanical fashion. You don't want really positive sentiments going on either. If you start congratulating yourself, when the concentration arises, the concentration is going to just go away. You just put the mind back on the breath. That's it. You can just do it over and over again. In fact, I would say one of the qualities of mind that helps the most with this kind of meditation is an almost machine-like attitude, a very kind of neutral, detached attitude toward it. So once established, mindfulness forms the foundation of any meditation. Let's take a look at our foundation. We have mindfulness, or sati, which is the mind's ability to stay with the object. For our purposes, this means the mind is paying attention to the breath. Mindfulness does not operate on its own. It's supported by alertness and ardency. These qualities of mind keep watch over the mind and make sure it's following the breath. And if it's not, it immediately brings the mind back to the breath without delay or sentiment. All three mental qualities, in turn, are supported by a body, which is calm and awake enough to get the job done. Once the mind is staying with the breath, we have established mindfulness, or satipatthana. I said a moment ago that mindfulness forms the foundation of any meditation. That means your meditation is only as strong as the mindfulness upon which it's established. In other words, mindfulness is very, very, very important to establish. So you have to give a lot of care and attention here. This also means that mindfulness is only a preparation for meditation, but it's not really meditation itself. Sometimes you hear about something called mindfulness meditation, and it's often conflated with vipassana, or insight meditation, but this is an incorrect usage of the words. It's true that we are developing some insight into ourselves, even at this early stage, but that's not really the kind of insight implied by insight meditation. That comes later. As I mentioned previously, mindfulness is a quality of mind that has applications apart from meditation proper. So the same qualities of mind here, mindfulness, alertness, and ardency, are required when you're performing a banishing or an invocation or while engaged in prayer or visualization. It's all mindfulness. If you're driving a car late at night in the snow, you need a lot of mindfulness. If you're using a chainsaw and don't want to cut off your leg, that's mindfulness. You're paying attention. So after we get mindfulness established, it's time to get to the work of insight meditation proper. So most discussions of insight meditation usually begin with a discussion of the so-called three characteristics of conditioned phenomena. Indeed, vipassana meditation is often defined as the sort of meditation that grants insight into these characteristics. However, I'm not going to begin with a discussion of them. This is because if one performs insight meditation, as I'm about to describe, knowledge of the three characteristics just happens on its own. Anyway, whether one uses those terms to describe what's happening is beside the point, because the experiences that are denoted by those terms happen. So you don't really need the concepts to actually do this. I'm going to give you pretty simple meditation instructions, but just because they're simple doesn't mean that they're easy to follow. The trick with these instructions, if you can call it that, is really just to follow them pretty much no matter what happens. of course you're going to fail. Everybody does. But the failures themselves are kind of instructive in a way, because they tell you where your hang-ups are, which is why it's really important to write down what happens in a session and really kind of pay attention to what's knocking you around. So the instructions I'm going to give you, I'm going to give you two sets of instructions. They're both based on this book, Practical Insight Meditation by Mahasi Saidow. If you're interested in what I'm talking tonight and you want to really get into this, boy, is that a great book. Wow. It goes into so much more detail on this than I'm going to be able to today. It's a really good book. So direct, so straightforward. So if you get lost with anything I'm saying, just go look at that. It's free online. Or feel free to ask me. The first technique is just going to be following the breath. This is what we were doing at the beginning of class. The first thing you do is relax the body, like we said. You really want to take your time here, because like I said, you want to get the energy right and get yourself really settled down. People often think that they're going to sit down and just, just like start meditating and it's just going to happen. It takes like 20, 25 minutes just to calm the fuck down, basically. So you really got to pay attention here and go through this slowly. Next thing you're going to do is you're going to follow the breath. It doesn't really matter where you follow the breath. The typical ones are the nose, the tip of the nose, or the abdomen. I kind of like the tip of the nose, personally. Other people prefer the abdomen. It doesn't really matter. That's your choice. But what I want you to do is pay attention to it in a certain way. To do Vipassana, what you really have to pay attention to are the sensations that compose the breath. And you have to follow them on a moment-to-moment basis, on a fast and interrupted basis. What do I mean? Notice, I want you to follow the sensations of the breath. The only way we know the breath is occurring is because the brain receives signals from the body. These signals are manifested in consciousness as particular sensations. It is by means of these particular sensations that the mind knows there is some macro phenomenon, like the breath taking place. What I want you to try to do is get behind your concept of the breath and to really know the breath at this kind of bare sensate level. I want you to follow these sensations of the breath and observe how they are changing from 1 second to the next. And I want you to do this with as little interruption as possible. That's what I mean by moment to moment. I mean fast and uninterrupted. This is my shitty diagram of a breath here. Oh, dear. So how can we begin to investigate the sensations of the breath? Well, for starters, we notice that the breath is not a unitary phenomenon, but it has two parts. It has the inhalation and the exhalation. So we can start investigating the breath by noticing the inhalation as it's occurring and noticing the exhalation as it's occurring. Notice I said as it is occurring, not that it is occurring. Everyone knows that inhalations and exhalations take place. Your job is to know them right as they're happening. This means you really have to pay attention to the breath and see how it's manifesting within your mind at that very moment. And if you want, you can say to yourself, rising, rising, rising with the inhalation, and falling, falling, falling with the exhalation. You don't have to do that. Some people find that it helps them concentrate. Now, if you investigate the breath this way for a bit, you'll probably realize there's more going on with the breath than just the inhalation and exhalation. There's also the pauses between each. And we were doing some of this before. The breath comes in, there's a short pause, breath goes out, there's a different pause. And the sensations that compose the pauses are somewhat different from one another. So instead of the breath being made up of just two kinds of sensations, there's actually four of them if we include the pauses. And again, you can say to yourself, rising, 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 pause, falling, 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 pause, pause, if it helps you concentrate. If you look even more closely at something like the inhalation, you might notice that that's composed of a beginning, middle, and end, and that those don't feel, that's not a single phenomenon either. The beginning feels different from the middle, and the middle feels different from the end. By this point, the mind starts acquiring a very fine awareness of the sensations composing the breath. What once presented itself as a unitary phenomenon is now observed to be composed of many smaller, microscopic phenomena, each with its own internal complexity. Your job as a meditator is to observe as much complexity in real time as you can. That's basically how you do Vipassana. I recommend trying to make a game out of it. See how many different parts of the breath you're able to discern. This is the same thing as seeing how fast you can get your mind to notice changes in the breath as it's occurring. Naturally, the mind's going to wander. If you just bring it back to the task. If you want, you can mentally label whatever the mind was doing when you notice that. If you're planning something, you just say planning, and then go back to the breath, or thinking, or remembering, whatever you want. You don't have to do that. You can just bring it back if you think that's too complicated. And that's pretty much all there is to this particular approach. The thing to remember here is to look at the breath as closely as possible. Don't just space out while following the breath. Try to get interested in it. Try to get close to it. Take a scientist's attitude toward it. If it helps, you can make believe you're observing the behavior of some kind of exotic mammal or insect, and then you write up a full report of it in the meditation journal. If you generate this kind of interest in the breath, it helps prevent distractions, which increases the concentration and which makes the breath reveal itself even more closely. It becomes a self-reinforcing process. Okay. The second technique I want to show you will appear quite different from the one I just showed you, but it generates similar results. This time, rather than concentrating on the breath, you're not going to bother concentrating on anything. You let the mind do almost whatever it wants. But there is one exception. Once a second, every second, mentally label what the mind is doing. So if you find yourself aware of an itch in your leg, you say feeling, or itching to yourself. If you find you're aware of the visual field, you say seeing to yourself. If you find you're aware of a thought, you say thinking to yourself. If you find you're aware of a mental image, you say imaging to yourself. If you notice dryness, then dryness or feeling. If there's aversion, then note aversion. If there's gladness, then note gladness. These are just some examples. You'll want to start by noticing one sensation per second. If at some point you don't know what to note, you say don't know or uncertainty. And then you just move on. Don't let a single second go by without noting something. I'll show it to you now. You do it like this. Seeing, feeling, heat. Seeing, uncertainty. Feeling, dryness, unpleasant. Dryness, tasting. Seeing, feeling, heat. Heat, uncertainty. Uncertainty, mental image, picturing. Uncertainty, just like that. Once a second. You can even do it out loud like that if you're by yourself and people won't think you're crazy. Hearing yourself say the things reinforces it. It's a feedback loop. The nice thing about this technique is that it does not require concentration to start. The noting will function as a mantra. This is what I was talking about before. It'll tie up the rational mind for a bit so that it can do the mindfulness and concentration get established eventually as you're doing this. Once you get good and concentrated, you have a choice. You can either go to the breath and do the breath meditation like I suggested, or you can just do this. I mean, for the 2 years that I did really intensive insight, I would say like more than half of my meditation was just doing this kind of stuff for like 40 minutes a day. I mean, some people really are drawn to this technique and some people don't like it. It worked really well for me. If at any point you find yourself confused about what to do, like if you're getting hung up on the stuff that I was saying before about alertness versus mindfulness versus am I analyzing the breath, blah, 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 just do this. As my friend Daniel likes to say, when in doubt, note it out. Again, I really highly, highly recommend this book. This is a really great book that you should check out, as both of these techniques are covered in a lot of detail there. Of course, the techniques are only going to work as well as a person is willing to apply them exactly as described. Unfortunately, in my experience, there are a lot of things going on in people's individual practices and even at retreat centers that are called insight meditation and that don't really have that much to do with meditation as I understand it, maybe apart from the fact that they're sitting on a cushion, I don't really know. So I think it's instructive here to take a look at some examples of what I would consider to be incorrect or subpar meditation and see how to turn them into better forms of meditation. So here's an example of this from a hypothetical meditator's diary. Sat down on the cushion to meditate. I closed my eyes and followed the breath. Pretty soon I found myself thinking about my argument with person X yesterday. I really wish X hadn't said to me what she said. It really is true what the Buddha says about suffering. You really can't count on anyone. But I really feel like I'm starting to take the Dharma to heart. I'm going to try to extend more compassion to X tomorrow. As the Buddha says, we all die anyway. Spent the remainder of my meditation time thinking about dinner. Nothing really got accomplished here. There's the appearance of an understanding of the Dharma, But really all that's happened is that there's some vague concept that's been applied in kind of a loose way without insight occurring. Mindfulness was never established, there's no alertness, there's no ardency. This person's basically philosophizing and psychoanalyzing themselves, not meditating. While this is a completely made-up journal entry, a lot of people do meditate like this. They're spending their entire time thinking about their personal problems, and you know, they're spending like group time with Dharma teachers asking about relationship or business advice. You know, even if the teacher is a celibate monk who can't touch money, they're asking about business advice. And I mean, I don't see what a monk would have to tell you about that. But here's a second example. Set my timer for 30 minutes and sat down to meditate. I began by following the breath, but was very soon distracted by a memory of my conversation with X yesterday. How dare she speak to me that way? Spent a few minutes thinking about X, what I was going to say to her the following day, before I realized my mind had wandered. Annoyed, I brought my mind back to the breath, but it just went off again. I felt disappointed, but tried not to judge my disappointment. Struggled with my legs going to sleep for the next 25 minutes. Timer went off. So just like, there's two good things happening here. One is that the person's setting a timer for their meditation, and there's at least an attempt to follow the breath. Unfortunately, mindfulness never really gets established because there's too much fascination with psychological content. Rather than just getting back to the breath, the meditator messes around with their feelings about leaving the breath. Also, they mention following the breath. We don't really find anything out about the breath. This means that they probably weren't focusing on it very closely. It's a common mistake, just trying to stare dumbly at the breath without really getting close to it and experiencing it at that kind of bare sensate level I was talking about. This is pretty bad meditation, but it represents probably the majority of the kind of stuff that people are doing with this, unfortunately. Okay, here's a slightly better one. Set my timer for 30 minutes, sat down to meditate. After settling in, let the attention rest on the sensation of the breath of the nostrils. I followed about 10 or 12 times before I got distracted by a thought about a coworker. I quickly realized I was distracted and brought my attention back to the breath. I followed fewer inhalations, exhalations before getting distracted again, this time by a different thing. I was a little annoyed, but I just brought the attention back to the breath again. The cycle repeated itself many times. Finally, it felt like I was really grooving with the breath, but then the alarm went off, so I stopped. This person's paying much more attention to what's going on. They know where the breath is occurring. They're talking about it at the nostrils, which is a good sign. They not only notice when they're getting distracted, they're noticing about how many times they're getting distracted. They also notice what it's like going back to the breath. This person is even starting to establish mindfulness by the end, but the alarm interrupts it. So maybe that tells them that it takes about 25 minutes to get settled down. Maybe they need a longer session. Set a timer for 45 minutes and sat down to meditate with eyes closed, legs folded on the floor. After about 15 or 20 minutes of the mind wandering around, getting knocked around by thoughts of coworkers, it really seemed to settle on the breath. I could feel it coming in and out of the nostrils, but the longer I stayed with it, the vaguer it seemed. The inhalation didn't seem to be just one sensation, but many little sensations, same with the exhalation. I also noticed there was a tendency for my mind to start wandering at the bottom of the exhalation in the gap right before the inhalation. During one of these gaps, I started having a memory of my conversation with X this afternoon. I noticed the movement in the pit of my stomach just as the memory arose. I noticed both the stomach sensation and the memory, and then went back to the breath. This is a person. This person doesn't just have right mindfulness going on. They're actually starting to do Vipassana here. They're noticing what's going on with the breath moment by moment. The breath itself is disappearing as a discrete object and is being observed as collections of sensations arising and passing moment to moment. Notice that this person is not immune from distractions. The focus of the breath is interrupted by the thought of a coworker, but the thought itself is just seen as another mental event. It's connected with other sensations in the body, which actually makes it easier to go back to the breath. Here's one more. After settling in, began following the breath at the nostrils. I felt like I floundered for the first 15 minutes, but eventually it felt like I got into a groove with the breath. As I followed each sensation at the tip of the nose, the tip of my nose started feeling really vague. Around this time, I started getting distracted by a sensation of itching at the top of my head. I noticed that it tended to increase in intensity at the middle of the inhalation and the exhalation, but it seemed to fade at the bottom of the exhalation. The itching became such a distraction that I decided to focus my attention on it instead of the breath. I tried to feel the borders of the itching area to get a sense of the size and shape of it. This really seemed to make the itching intensify, which gave rise to anger. I noticed the anger, but I continued to observe the itching until the alarm went off. The itching stopped. I wonder if my meditation was getting worse. Despite their concern about their ability, this is a person who's actually meditating well and actually recording their session really, really well. Not only are they investigating the phenomena correctly, but whether they know it or not, actual insight into the three characteristics is starting to take place here. This entry also illustrates a technique that's sometimes called switching. So if you're trying to concentrate on the breath or your primary object, and there's something that's distracting you, like a really strong pain, a feeling of heat, or itching, you can switch your attention over to that and make that be the object of the meditation, either until the end of the session or until it goes away. All right. So we've looked at the foundation of insight meditation and good insight technique. Let's take a closer look at the exact sort of insight produced by these directions. So it's customary in any discussion of insight meditation to speak about the so-called three characteristics of existence. Indeed, the insight denoted in the name insight meditation is really insight into these three characteristics. So it may seem odd that I've gone on at some length about mindfulness and good insight without once mentioning them. But the reasons for this are threefold. The first one is that it doesn't really require an understanding of insight of three characteristics in order to do insight meditation. This is the kind of statement which might prompt some Vipassana teachers to be tempted to throw a chair through a window, but I'm pretty sure it's true. There is no way, it's not necessary to understand what the three characteristics are or how to perceive them in order to perform insight. What I've instructed you in is really the essence, in other words. So I encourage you to return to the basic practices again and again. That's really the key. The second reason is that it's easy to misinterpret the meaning of the three characteristics. Most people are liable to hear them and think they are somehow predicates of all beings whatsoever, such that it becomes valid to say, all things are in flux, or there exists nowhere a self, or the popular, all is suffering. Then one becomes fixated on thinking philosophically about these three characteristics, wondering if there is such a thing as free will or a true self, or whether it's okay to enjoy chocolate and sex. But this is not the use of the three characteristics intended by the Buddha himself, who treats them more as a particular way of seeing than an itemized list of things contained in the universe. Worst of all, this way of thinking about things puts one in a cast of mind where it is too easy to spend one's time thinking in a general half-assed way about the nature of things as opposed to getting into the breath. Some of those examples of bad meditation I showed you earlier are really examples of philosophizing or just reflecting. The third reason I have failed to mention them until now is that if you proceed exactly as I have instructed you, observing the changes in the breath, knowledge of the three characteristics develops organically on its own without any interference whatsoever from the rational mind. Whether one ever knows anything about the so-called three characteristics or uses those terms is entirely beside the point. The experiences corresponding to the meanings of those terms arise naturally for the disciplined practitioner, and such experiences are all that is necessary for deep transformation to take place. As for the words themselves, these are the Pali words, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Pali is a Middle Indo-Aryan dialect that was spoken in northern India, and it's the language the Buddha's teachings were eventually written down in, but they were probably not the language the Buddha himself spoke. Anicca just means inconstancy or impermanence. It refers to the fact that all sensory phenomena, basically anything we can experience in the physical, mental, or social worlds, is in a state of change. For example, the breath initially presents as a unitary phenomenon, but upon closer examination, it turns out to be composed of many little individual sensations, happening one after the other. Dukkha is a difficult one to translate. It's composed of the Indo-European roots du and ka. Du is a prefix indicating something is bad. So for example, dvastika means living poorly. Ka is just means space. It seemed to originally signify the whole of a wheel into which an axle was fit. A dukkha, therefore, is a bad space or maybe a bad fit between wheel and axle. The Indo-Europeans invented chariots, so it's no surprise their metaphor for a bad time that has something to do with wheels and axles. In the context of the Buddhist philosophy, it roughly means unsatisfactoriness or stress. Sometimes it's translated as suffering, but this is incorrect, mostly on account of it being too specific. For reasons that are not immediately apparent, but which will become clear later, in the context of the breath, dukkha refers to the breaking up and passing away of one sensation before the arising of the next. This may become conspicuous at the end of the inhalation. Anatta means not self, the lack of any subsisting essence of anything. In the context of the breath, it means the sensations composing the breath arise on their own, abide, and pass away completely on their own without my choice or interference. It also refers to the fact that the sensations composing the breath occur precisely where they are and are not being relayed back to a center point of experience or a transcendental subject. Notice I keep returning the discussion to the sensations composing the breath. This is because knowledge of the sensations composing the breath, essentially knowledge of those sensations exactly as they're occurring, that's the essential thing. Without real-time knowledge of the sensations of the breath, or without moment-to-moment noting of experience, there is no true insight into the three characteristics. Our knowledge of them remains mostly general and theoretical, but general theoretical insight is not the kind of insight that forces change. The kind of detailed observation I'm recommending is what really tends to make this knowledge sink in. Now, it's not the case that one is analyzing the breath and then all of a sudden there's just full understanding of the three characteristics, like Athena leaping from Zeus's head. Understanding of the three characteristics develops in a gradual, progressive manner. It's built up bit by bit, and the knowledge becomes deeper and more comprehensive as the ability to observe and analyze sensations becomes faster and more refined. Knowledge of the three characteristics unfolds in a predictable manner, according to a series of steps Mahasi Sayadaw has called progressive insight. The first stage that manifests is called analytical knowledge of mind and body, or just mind and body for short. This stage is marked by the ability of the meditator to recognize that both mental and physical events are experienced objects, and therefore they are not self. In other words, it's not as though there is a consciousness over here that is aware of an object over there. Rather, both consciousness and its object are occurrences existing alongside one another. This is a pretty cool experience the first time it happens, if I can be technical. There will be a pretty clear recognition that there is the breath, and there is the noticing of the breath, but both the breath and the noticing are objects. Neither is a self. Depending on how tranquil the mind is when it happens, this insight can be accompanied by strong gladness, even bliss. One may even be tempted to think they're enlightened here, since they've really gotten it in a way that they hadn't previously. It's easy to get so excited that you lose the meditation, which is pretty much what happened to me the first time this happened. But if you continue to meditate exactly as you have been, the next stage will arise. The next stage is knowledge by discerning conditionality, also known as cause and effect. Since mental events and physical events are already being seen together, it will become obvious moment to moment how one affects the other. For example, a thought of a friend arises, and I notice the arising of gladness in connection with that thought, along with physical sensations in the chest or face. If I am engaged in the process of walking meditation, the intention to lift the foot preceding the actual lifting of the foot becomes conspicuous. Some physical discomfort may begin to arise at this stage. The next stage is called knowledge of comprehension. Comprehension of what? Comprehension of the conditioned nature of everything arising and experience. One starts noticing not only that one event gives rise to another, but also that while the first event is occurring, it itself is in a stage of change and decay. And it is not until the first thing has completely decayed and passed away that the second thing takes place and decays in turn. When I said that the three characteristics arise completely on their own without anything other than strong moment-to-moment noticing of exactly what's going on, this is basically what I meant. And for this reason, this stage is sometimes called the three characteristics. While it was mostly anatta, or not self, that was conspicuous in the mind and body stage, and while anicca, or impermanence, became more conspicuous during the cause and effect proportion, now the mind really begins to notice the breaking up of phenomena more, what we're calling dukkha. It may seem strange to equate dukkha with the breaking up of a sensation, but at this stage of meditation, it's common for physical pain to start to become really conspicuous. There may be very strong pains in the head, back, or neck that go away as soon as the meditation session is over. Hot and cold flashes are common, so is incessant itching. Again, these tend to go away as soon as one ends the session. It's tempting to end the session early, or at least back off, but if you continue to refine your experience of the sensations of the breath, or even if you just turn your attention to the heat or the itching and observe those phenomena very closely, and if you all do this persistently, mechanically, the fourth stage will occur. The fourth stage is called knowledge of the arising and passing away, or the arising and passing, or the AMP for short. What happens here is that the speed of noticing greatly increases, more or less on its own. While the mind was struggling a moment ago to keep up with the sensations of pain and heat, suddenly the task is almost effortless now. It can feel here like you've reached the top of a very steep hill on a bicycle, and now you've started to accelerate down the other side. This marks entry into the AMP. One of the first things people often notice here is very bright flashing lights. This is then often accompanied by rapture. There's usually some kind of instantaneous understanding of things here, which gives one great faith in the Dharma. It's common to exclaim something to the effect of, "That's what they mean." This is usually an extremely dramatic stage. There can be flashing lights, the ability to see through closed eyelids, the sense that the body is dissolving. There can be strong unitive experiences, like feeling you have merged with the universe. Excuse me. Waves of bliss rolling up and down the back are common, along with other kundalini-like effects. People sometimes report psychic abilities manifesting at this stage. Mania is common in those prone to it. Unlike the previous three stages, the AMP tends to have profound off-the-cushion effects. Sex drive will often increase, sleep will often be interrupted, dreams will be vivid. Almost anything that can be covered under the heading mystical experience can occur here. The desire to radically transform one's life, even to quit one's job and move to a monastery or out into the desert, can arise. The first time this experience happened to me, it was actually pretty low-key. I simply realized my physical body wasn't solid, but was just made up of these individual kind of sensory snapshots that were happening. And I had the thought, oh, that's what they mean by the body not being solid. Okay. And then my meditation just got very strong after that, and it seemed like I could analyze the back of my hand into what seemed like hundreds of little flashing sensations. That's what I mean by the attention getting very fast. Whereas another time it happened to me, I was asleep and I was having a dream about meditation, and when I woke, there were just waves of like bliss going up and down my back, and it felt like there was like an entity outside of me that was like taking care of me and loving me. So I mean, this can manifest a lot of different ways, and it can also occur outside of the context of insight meditation. I've experienced this while doing middle pillar and circulation of body of light. This can come up, big strong feeling of rapture, especially when you have the visualization of the lights and the energy moving around. It can really get this going. This can occur a lot of different ways. So it's really common for people to think that they're enlightened at this stage. It's also common for them to be burdensome to other people in their lives, as they won't stop talking about the Dharma and their experiences about things. A person in the throes of the AMP may begin to think that others just don't get it, they're not spiritual enough, and they're going to want to give up on them. Really bad idea. Really, really bad idea. Shouldn't do that. If a person gets very attached to these sorts of experiences, it's likely they'll get stuck at the stage or in the territory that immediately follows. It's normal for these sorts of experiences to occur. It's kind of silly to try to avoid them if you're doing deep insight, but deep understanding really doesn't arise until you can kind of get past these sorts of things and not really cling to them. You have to start to see these things as unreliable and temporary as well. After the arising and passing, there arise a number of stages which are collectively called the dark night by many meditators. I am not sure who began to call it the dark night. The earliest reference I've seen is by Jack Kornfield, but the meaning is very close to that employed by Aleister Crowley in Magic and Theory and Practice, which I'm going to get to at the end. The first thing the meditator is going to notice is that the bright lights, fine vibrations, and ecstasy of the arising and passing will dissipate and finally disappear. This will be replaced by an acute awareness of the breaking up of individual sensations. So instead of noticing the beginning, middle, and end of each sensation, the mind will tend to land on the end of each sensation of the breath. Insofar as mental sensations like thoughts and tensions and the like arise, they're going to be noticed the same way too. You're going to notice things falling off and decaying. This set of stages can manifest psychologically a number of ways. It's common to experience some fear at this point, as it can easily feel like the body or the thoughts are constantly in a state of passing away or a kind of moment-to-moment dying. Bodily processes themselves can become conspicuous and appear disgusting. You'll notice like the saliva in your mouth or feelings of digestion going on or sweat. Interest in food and drink can begin to fall off and then become generalized into a disgust with worldly things. As the entire world begins to appear worthless, one can begin to wonder at all what the point of living is. Suicidal ideation is rare here, but it can occur in those with serious mental illness. This tends to culminate in a stage known as reobservation. All the psychological distress noted earlier intensifies, but it's often accompanied with strong physical pain too. both the mind and body torment the meditator ceaselessly. It can become almost impossible to meditate, as one is constantly wanting to switch positions. A person on retreat may very well leave the retreat at this point, having had more than enough with all this Vipassana stuff. I remember hitting this stage like a brick wall on a retreat that I was on. I was a new meditator, and I was extremely hopped up on my own abilities, and I was so obsessed with my ability as a meditator that I actually would not stop thinking about it while meditating, and I could not meditate because of this. That seems really funny in a way, but it was actually really horrible, and I actually did break down crying at one point in the basement of the retreat center. It's really funny because I was listening to a talk by a guy named Shinsen Young the other day, who's a key figure in this pragmatic Dharma movement. And he was talking about an experience he had of this where he was at a Zen retreat. And he said that the monks broke like 3 or 4 canes over people's backs in just the first few days of the retreat because they were just disciplining the hell out of these people. But he was sitting there in this state with all this pain, and he kept saying to himself, "I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to cry." And he actually made it through the thing. Point is, I cried. That's what I'm trying to say. I lost it. Briefly. Finally, what happened was I just began noticing the anger and the feeling of being upset, since that was the most conspicuous thing. It's like those feelings were begging to be looked at, in a way. And that's when a drastic shift took place. All the physical pain and psychological distress was occurring, and with the exact same intensity, and yet none of it was bothering me anymore. There was no longer a me to be bothered by any of it. Everything seemed impersonal now. Every time an unwanted thought arose, the mind would notice it and think, "That's what the heart wants." It became like a mantra. Soon, even the unwanted thought stopped, and I moved into the next stage. The first thing one notices in this stage is that the mind is apparently impartial to anything that arises in it. Hence, this stage is called knowledge of equanimity, about formations, or equanimity. The most conspicuous thing about this stage is that although phenomena are clearly seen as impermanent, stressful, and impersonal, there is no longer any mental anguish with regard to these facts. Everything is viewed in a very matter-of-fact way. This dispassion continues for a while, even after the meditation stops. It is deep and strong. Like both mind and body and the AMP, equanimity is a unit of experience, but it's also extremely spacious, even panoramic. There can be the experience of floating in the middle of an extremely large space. Equilibrium can be disrupted during walking meditation. Visuals behind the eyes can be vivid, three-dimensional, and lifelike. The attention to detail has become extremely fine at this point, to such an extent and degree that the arising and passing seems coarse by comparison. The breath or any part of the body will seem composed of extremely fine particulate sensations. Mental sensations, even those initially called me or mind, will look the same way. Experience is happening, but it is not at all clear to whom or to what it is happening. These realizations are accompanied by neither positive nor negative mental associations. Equanimity pervades all. It's common to be able to sit for very long periods while in equanimity, since almost no pain arises in the body. If one is on retreat, meditation will happen effortlessly from sunrise until late at night. Off retreat, one is doing sitting or walking meditation for many hours as though it is nothing. Subtle mental processes become conspicuous now. One begins to notice fine acts of attention, intention, subtle desires. These are the formations signified in the name of the stage, equanimity about formations. If one gets to this stage on a retreat, it is likely that one will continue to reach it for the duration of the retreat. There can arise subtle frustration here, as it is unclear what else one can or should do. Eventually, this desire for something else or the next thing is itself seen clearly as just another conditioned phenomenon. If that desire for becoming is itself relinquished, the next set of stages will arise. There are 3 or 4 stages at this point, depending on whose map you go by, but the whole thing happens so quickly there's very little point dissecting it. Generally, what happens is that you're in this wide-open, spacious, equanimous state. Suddenly, something happens, like a hiccup in the meditation, a quick flash of light, or feeling of being pulled up and dropped quickly, and suddenly you find yourself no longer in that open, spacious place anymore. If your body was vague and dispersed before, it seems to suddenly materialize back on the cushion, almost with a thud. There's a half-second pause, and then there's a rush of tingling waves up your spine that collect at the back of the head and suddenly burst forth from the crown. This transition is called magaphala, or fruit of the path, aka fruition. The first time it happens, a person becomes a sotapanna, or stream winner, they have achieved the first of the four classical stages of enlightenment. After this happens, one enters a stage called review. Every time the yogi sits down to meditate, they start at the arising and passing away. Then they can ascend back through the dark night into equanimity and repeat the fruition as many times as they want. Review lasts days or weeks, not usually months. Eventually, there comes a point where meditation seems to start at the first stage, mind and body again. At that point, review is over, and the yogi begins their pursuit of the other classical three stages of enlightenment. Unfortunately, I'm not able to treat of this territory beyond stream entry, as that truly would take us into the territory of advanced practice. However, I would like to present some tentative conclusions with regard to the ground we've covered today. As may or not be obvious from what I have shown, the progress of insight describes the path of initiation, EAO. According to Aleister Crowley in Magic and Theory and Practice, this formula is the principal and most characteristic formula of Osiris, of the redemption of mankind. I is Isis, nature ruined by A, Apophis destroyer, and restored to life by the Redeemer, Osiris. In beginning a meditation practice, there is always a quiet pleasure, a gentle natural growth. One takes a lively interest in the work. It seems easy, one is quite pleased to have started. The stage represents Isis. Sooner or later, it is succeeded by depression, the dark night of the soul, an infinite weariness and detestation of the work. The simplest and easiest acts become almost impossible to perform. Such impotence fills the mind with apprehension and despair. The intensity of this loathing can hardly be understood by any person who has not experienced it. This is the period of Apophis. It is followed by the arising not of Isis, but of Osiris. The ancient condition is not restored, but a new and superior condition is created, a condition only rendered possible by the process of death. The first four stages of the progress of insight, starting with mind and body and leading up to the arising and passing, represent the I in this formula. Rapture, energy, and faith are strong during these initial phases. This gives way to the dark night of the soul, or A. During this phase, both poles of the subject-object division are challenged. The object, which was initially taken to be a source of fulfillment, is now seen to be devoid of any satisfying qualities. The subject is forced to surrender the illusion of its complete autonomy. This leads to its auto-relinquishment and rebirth at stream entry, represented by O in this formula. So then are we to conclude that the method of insight meditation is a relic of the old aeon? Isn't this just a repeat of the tired myth of the suffering self-slain god, this time told about the modern subject? You know, Crowley goes on to say, it will now be understood that this formula of EIO is a formula of Tefereth. The magician who employs it is conscious of himself as a man liable to suffering and anxious to transcend that state by becoming one with God. It will appear to him as the supreme ritual, as the final step, but it has already been pointed out it is but a preliminary. For the normal man today, however, it represents considerable attainment, and there is a much earlier formula whose investigation will occupy chapter 6. Unfortunately, it would take us beyond the scope of this introductory course to fully unpack Crowley's analysis of this formula and to explore all the implications for insight meditation and mysticism generally. Suffice to say, I agree with Crowley's ambivalence toward this method of spiritual attainment. It's true that it provides only a partial picture of reality, and yet there is undoubtedly something intrinsically compelling about the version of reality projected by EAO. In its essence, this formula promises release from the pain of this world. In the Iron Age, the source of this pain was thought to be original sin or clinging. Nowadays, it's more fashionable to say all our problems are caused by the ego, whatever that means. But inside nearly every person I've ever met who felt strongly attracted by spiritual paths was that sense of internal corruption, that sense of a fatal flaw driving them to seek relief in heaven, in resurrection, in altered states, in the dissolution of boundaries, or in the oblivion of the non-dual. Anyone who has ever hungered for such an escape has fallen in love with the picture of things portrayed by this formula. It's trivially easy to sneer at such notions, but to really get past these old aeon reflexes means to go deeply into them, to inhabit them, to take them to their conclusions, to see where they finally break down and open out onto something bigger. As J. Daniel Gunther says, the formula of the dying god, divorced from the glorification of suffering, is not abrogate. It has been assimilated into a broader comprehension of nature and subsequently the psychosoma of mankind. In my experience, this means discovering that the transcendence afforded by insight is real. It's just not a representation of the whole of reality. It's easy to believe the picture we form of things in the throes of spiritual experience is an image of the way things ultimately are. It's tempting to construct a special sense of self around such experiences and to wall it off from the rest of reality. In this way, spiritual experiences are like traumatic experiences. They're experienced internally as a disruption of normal flow of time and narrative. And yet in my experience, the deepest insights come not from the view granted at the summit of the mountain, nor the confusion in the darkness below, nor some average taken between the two, but rather by understanding that all manner of experiences, exalted, low, or downright boring, occur in the larger context of life itself. We can never transcend or overcome life by means of mystical experience, only render our notion of it deeper, richer, and more internally complex as a result. Love is the law, love under one. Thank you for indulging me.